trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis day. Oh, Don, it's been in the 80s last week. It's going to be in the 90s this week. It's just such perfect summer weather.
It's been in the 80s, I think, for 3 weeks now. We have been below average, slightly too substantially, since June 18th, I think is what I just looked up here. We've been in the mid to upper 80s. Today, July 8th. As Lois and I are preparing the show for broadcast on July 9, 2026, it's going to be a high of 88 degrees. Right now it's 64 degrees. Tonight's low will be 55. And then we do apparently bump up a little bit above what we've been running for the last couple of weeks. Thursday, the high will be 92 and sunny and clear. And I can just kind of leave the sunny and clear on there for the rest of the broadcast. Friday, 89 degrees and sunny. Friday night, 56 degrees. Actually, a few clouds sneak in on Saturday, 92 degrees, mostly sunny. Saturday night, partly cloudy, so it's only going to drop to 60 degrees. Sunday, partly sunny, 92. Sunday night, partly cloudy, 61. Heating up a bit next week. Both Weather Underground and the National Weather Service are telling us that starting on Monday, we'll be a little bit warmer. We'll be about 95 Monday with a low at 61, and Tuesday will be 96 degrees with a low of also 61. So a warming trend for next week. We've been having some remarkably mild weather here. It's been great planting weather, great tomato fruit set weather. Your tomato plants should be just about filling their cages by now and should have set a lot of fruit over the last couple of weeks. We will talk a little bit about blossom end rot because that's showing up a bit, but very few problems overall on tomatoes so far this year. Let's go through our announcements real quick.
Coming up for the Master Gardeners, we have July 23rd, Composting with Worms. Ooh. And that's Janet Arias. And then August 13, Kevin Marini will be talking about best practices of great gardeners. Ooh, that sounds interesting.
Bohart Museum of Entomology is having Moth Night.
Oh, goody. That's always fun.
Saturday, July 18th from 7 to 10 p.m. And you can get more information at bohart.ucdavis.edu. Moth Night, Saturday, July 18, 2026 is free for all ages, free weekend parking. It's at the UC Davis Bohart Museum of Entomology, 7 to 10 p.m. That's at the Academic Surge Building on Crocker Lane. Obviously, just go look at the event and get your map to get you there. And then at the UC Davis Arboretum and Public Garden, you can visit with entomologist Joel Hernandez as he blacklights for moths outside, 9:30 to 11:30 p.m. So it's Moth Night, Saturday, July 18th from 7 to 11:30. You can learn about moths, look at the research collection, talk to experts, fun activities for all ages, and then watch as an entomologist runs a blacklight to draw moths that you can look at alive. Bohart, B-O-H-A-R-T, .ucdavis.edu, and it's cross-pollinated, you might say, at arboretum.ucdavis.edu as well.
You have been listening to the KDRT radio station, and Don wants you to support us. Don, how do they do that?
Well, if you like what you hear, you just head on over to kdrt.org and click on the support button. We just got a new air conditioner. We need some money. Please help us pay for it. kdrt.org.
The new air conditioner should have fixed the problem that we had because it got too hot in there.
Yes, we need a special air conditioner for upstairs where all of that stuff is. And the station was overheating. We're so hot here. The things we talk about, we overheated the station. First thing I want to do is send you over to my old friend, Farmer Fred, who did a podcast a couple of years ago about blossom end rot. Is that the order we were going to do this in, or did I get us?
That's okay. We'll just do it.
Okay, we'll just do that.
The title of the program is, this episode is dealing with tomato blossom end rot. And you can read the whole thing if you go to his gardenbasics.substack.com. And all of his articles are there. I think you have to subscribe in order to read all of these because he's using it to earn money.
Yeah, he makes a living writing about
This is where he
gardening.
makes
Amazing,
a living, yeah.
amazing concept. Yes, he's on Substack, and of course you can listen to his podcast and subscribe to that as well and listen to us talk about it. Very good timing on this one. Obviously, this is when blossom end rot is likeliest to show up because it's usually a problem on the very first tomatoes that develop. And so we're accustomed to talking to people in late June, early July about blossom end rot on fruit that was developing back in early May. There's a lot of myth and lore about blossom end rot. It can be one of those very, very challenging subjects because everyone's going to jump in and give you the same answer, which happens to be wrong. But the podcast itself was great. We had fun talking about it. I just want to go over one part of it here where I replied to a question, and it really kind of sums up my position on blossom end rot, which is usually attributed to a calcium deficiency or other problems. Here's what I said. 4 years ago. Let's be optimistic. We're in an area where it's really easy to grow tomatoes in general. Most of California, we have a climate that allows us to grow them without using a lot of pesticides or other remedies for problems. But with respect to blossom end rot, shows up almost always on some of the very first tomatoes that set, the ones that people get so excited about, the first ones. They set early, they planted early, they want to beat the season, they get some fruit set on there, they look on the bottom. If the fruit is still green, you'll sometimes notice a little discoloration, a little oddity on the bottom. That looks sort of mottled, you might say, on the blossom end of the fruit. That is to say, you know, the fruit develops at the base of the flower. As it ripens, that part is soft and mushy and unpalatable. Yes, you can eat the rest of the fruit, assuming bacterial decay didn't set in. It's usually fairly isolated. It's very disappointing, though, when that happens with the very first fruit that you set, usually on the first fruit. Sometimes happens later, but usually on the first. What we know about blossom end rot is that it's primarily a disorder related to low temperatures during the fruit expansion phase and sometimes having kept the soil too wet when the nights are cold. I'm going to digress from my prepared remarks here a little bit. I've looked at a lot of research studies on blossom end rot. It's been the subject of considerable research since about the 1930s and 40s. A lot of that research went into the direction of calcium in the plant or in the soil being the problem, because calcium is really integral to the structure of cell walls. So strong cell walls are a function of calcium content. If a plant is having any kind of root disorder, caused by temperature or saturated soil or weird ion conditions because of people adding the wrong kind of fertilizer or high pH or very low pH or other things like that, all coming together at one time as the fruit is in the vulnerable expansion phase, the plant can't get calcium up through the plant to the most distant part from the roots,
which is the fruit.
The bottom of the fruit, right? Not the whole fruit, not the leaves, not the flowers, the very bottom of the fruit. There's insufficient calcium in there. The cell walls are not sturdy, therefore they collapse. That's what appears to be happening. Hence the focus on calcium. And studies that were done in the 40s and 50s found, look, we find an apparent deficiency of calcium in the pedicel, which is the stem that holds the fruit. So look, there's an apparent deficiency here. We have identified it clearly. The problem is insufficient calcium. So when we first opened our nursery, 1981, there were calcium products on the market that you could put on the ground, or you could use gypsum, which contains calcium, or you could buy liquid calcium sprays to spray on the plant, because obviously the problem was a lack of calcium. But the problem was not a lack of calcium in the soil, because if you measured your soil, you had a soil test done, you had adequate calcium. It was not a lack of calcium in the plant. There was not a deficiency overall in the plant. It wasn't getting to the point it needed to get to. So you didn't, applying calcium wasn't going to solve the problem of a shortage of calcium in that part of the fruit. That's when we realized this was an environmental problem causing a physiological disorder. So applying calcium to the ground clearly didn't work. So we all jumped to the spray. Quick, buy this liquid spray. That'll solve the problem. Placebo effect is very, very real in horticulture. Placebo effect is when you apply something, the problem is solved. Therefore, you think your application of that thing solved the problem. That's what we would see repeatedly with blossom end rot. People would spray with Folical, and the next fruit came on just fine.
But it didn't cure the fruit that had the blossom end rot.
Right.
It just, the next fruit was fine, which would have been fine anyway. How long does it take between when the blossom gets pollinated and the fruit gets to the expansion stage? How long is that?
It's a couple weeks. Yeah, it's a couple weeks. The division stage, the fruit seems pretty pretty safe, I
You
guess, is
can't
the term.
tell that there's a
You
problem.
don't see a problem. But expansion phase, which is the rather rapid period of a few weeks, 3 to 4 weeks, when the fruit is expanding rapidly after having divided, the cells divide, then they enlarge and expand. That's when the fruit seems to be vulnerable to various problems. In particular, cat facing from thrips, cat facing from weather, and in the case of blossom end rot, just the lack of calcium down the bottom of the fruit. The fruit expands, it does all the right stuff, and then those cells collapse. That's what's happening.
So it's if it's from when you made your mistake to when you see the squishy bottom is, you know, 2, 3, 4 weeks, it's like trying to tell your cat, I'm punishing you now for something you did 5 hours ago. There's no correlation that it doesn't.
Did you do this with your cat?
No, I'm just, I've heard that story.
It's a metaphor. Yes, I get it.
It sounds like the biggest problem is that people aren't connecting the current problem with 3 or 4 weeks ago.
Right. And as we like to say here, you know, this week's weather is next week's problem. In this case, what we're dealing with typically with blossom end rot is 4 to 6 weeks prior or something in that range somewhere. It's 7 weeks from blossom set to ripening on an early girl tomato. So that's your starting point. Somewhere in that 7 week process, something went wrong with uptake and distribution of these minerals in the plant. And typically it associates with cold temperatures and soggy soil. So if it's, you know, windy and rainy, we have an unseasonal storm coming through and you're about to irrigate, maybe that would be a time not to irrigate. It's usually not something you've done. This is the first thing. You didn't cause this. It's a physiological.
You planted in February.
Right. If you plant too early, then the first fruit is likelier to show up because we know it's temperature related. They also see it in areas with very high temperatures at times. And then looking at some of the really interesting studies on blossom end rot, where they would try to use different things like calcium, which is a cation, and potassium, which is a cation, and magnesium, which is in Epsom salts, they would find that they could have some influence on it by changing the proportions of those in the root zone in, for example, hydroponic systems where tomatoes are grown in hydroponics in greenhouses in Florida because they're a very high value crop. They managed to control blossom end rot in one study I looked at by careful application of potassium. I'm not saying run out and buy potassium. I'm saying they discovered that managing the cation exchange capacity and the amount of cations in the root zone of the plant made a difference in that particular instance. But you don't want to mess around with soil chemistry because you don't know for sure what's causing it. And the only thing you could do that would be wrong, that would be exacerbating the problem, would be high application of something with a high cation level, such as Epsom salts, for example. Magnesium is a cation that displaces other cations in the soil. So if you put a bunch of Epsom salts on there, you could inadvertently make blossom end rot worse. Fortunately, most people use Epsom salts in very small amounts. Even though they're needless, they're not usually doing any harm with them. But the other is the wrong kind of fertilizer. So if you're using ammonia-based fertilizers, this was clearly correlated in one study many years ago with the presence of blossom end rot. Ammonia was a very popular fertilizer post-World War II. Still is in a lot of fertilizers you buy if you're using synthetic fertilizers. I'm not saying ammonia causes this every time. I'm saying that ammonia can contribute to the problem because it's a very reactive positive ion, cation, in the soil. So use of ammonia fertilizers. Ammonia sulfate, when we first opened, was a common loss leader at garden centers and hardware stores. You'd go around, my dad would do this, go around and you'd buy your $2 bag of steer manure and your $5 bag of sulfate of ammonia, and that's what you're going to use to start your garden that year. Ammonium sulfate is 2100 with 14% sulfur, but it's also very reactive, very rapidly reactive, makes ammonia NH4 positive, which becomes a gas, which can affect the root zone. It's something you got to use carefully. And if you weren't using it carefully, you could make your blossom end rot problem worse. So the two things you could do would be to apply the wrong kind of cations in large numbers or the wrong kind of fertilizer, cations, but specifically in that case, in large amounts. If you use a nitrate fertilizer or a urea-based fertilizer or an organic fertilizer, you wouldn't typically make the problem worse. Most commonly, though, we see it here, it's just cold and wet. So you plant too early, the plants are going okay. We have a slightly unseasonal storm or something, which happened here in late April, for example. We were much colder than average. We actually had rainfall. We had rainfall again about a week later with colder than average temperatures. I made a note, probably going to see some blossom end rot about the first week of July. And indeed we did, because 7 to 8 weeks after that incident is when you're likely to actually see it manifested in the fruit. So you didn't do anything wrong unless you tried to correct it the wrong way. How's that?
Or you can avoid the problem by not planting quite so early, waiting until it's warmer.
That helps.
And if you did plant early, you get a jump on things, maybe you just want to pick off the first fruit that's set. But then what's the point of planting early?
Well, that does raise that question. But yes, just pick them off, throw them away. The next ones will almost always be fine. We will say that there are certain varieties that are just well known for getting blossom end rot. In particular, Roma, which is a very popular sauce tomato. It's a determinate one. So it's setting a bunch of fruit, and a bunch of the first ones that set will typically have blossom end rot, even in a normal year. But they set so heavily. If you just pick those, yes, you can use them. Again, they're perfectly usable. But if you just pick those, if they bother you, throw them away. The next ones that come on will be fine. We don't see it here through the season. You may be listening in places where, I don't know, you have delayed warming, you're colder as you go into the early summer. You might be seeing it there. Just manage your irrigation more carefully is the one bit of advice we can give you. Deep watering carefully when temperatures are cooler than average, and be cautious about what kind of fertilizer you use. Products for blossom end rot are not proven. And the ones that are being sold, I think, are based on very, very old, outdated science. So this is one thing, by the way, I had some fun testing AI for. What causes blossom end rot?
Calcium.
It is the most common answer you'll get, because for years, extension publications continued this forward because the early research suggested that calcium deficiency was the problem. Therefore, here's the part that is the problem. Therefore, we should apply calcium was not the logical conclusion from that. We should figure out why the plant is not distributing calcium that's already present. It never made sense to us at our nursery, because when we opened 1981, Davis was on relatively shallow wells with groundwater that was laden with calcium. If you watered with a drip system, which was a fairly new thing at that time, around each emitter, you get this ring of white crystalline powder on the soil, which was from the calcium and the boron in our water. It was visible. So it was hard to imagine that the plant was having a calcium deficiency that was related to soil or water. Therefore, it was some sort of internal deficiency. Why is it having that internal deficiency? Temperature. One thing I'd add to this is that we see other nutrient deficiencies in tomatoes early in the season. This year, for example, I went ahead and planted several of them early just to test what you guys like to do. Put them in about 3 weeks ahead of schedule, and they immediately showed phosphorus deficiency. I recognize that as a purple discoloration of the foliage. Does that mean that there was no phosphorus? No, my soil has loads of phosphorus. Should I apply phosphorus? No, of course not. It's not going to take it up. It's a temperature-related thing. I then had, a week after I planted, 6 of my tomatoes, 3 weeks too early, intentionally, just to see what would happen. I had apparent nitrogen deficiency in 3 or 4 of them, which is recognizable. I knew the symptoms. There was plenty of nitrogen in the soil. I was not going to feed these plants to try and correct something that I knew was not related to a soil deficiency. So before you do anything to your soil, have a soil test done. It's possible that you have a phosphorus deficiency if you're in some regions where it is deficient, or if you brought in soil that you purchased, you know, that was just basically topsoil or something like that. A deficiency of phosphorus can be a factor in blossom end rot, but we are almost never deficient in phosphorus in this area. So I'm just mentioning that for folks living in other areas. You'll run into potassium deficiency. Well, you can't really hurt a plant by applying a little extra potassium, but I don't want to promise that that's going to solve your problem. I'm just saying that generally speaking, this is a temperature-related phenomenon.
You just said you can't hurt the plant by adding extra
potassium.
Is potassium something that runs off in the water, and might you be hurting other things?
Not really. It's not really a pollution issue. And it's, here's the thing. I've looked at lots and lots of soil tests. I highly recommend, if you're new to an area and you've got a brand new yard, that you get your soil tested. Send it out to a soils lab and have it tested. I have never actually seen a potassium deficiency on soil tests in our area. I've also never seen phosphorus even below high levels in our area. Usually there's a bar chart, and it's at the very top of where the bar chart will go. So we're not deficient in those things here. But I had to look up what would an excess of potassium look like in a plant. It's hard to overdo it. Don't worry too much about that. The issue with phosphorus, and one of the reasons we are constantly reminding you that phosphorus does not stimulate bloom, does not prevent blossom end rot, does not do all the things that are claimed for it. It can be a pollutant. It is adsorbed very rapidly by the soil particles. So it's held by the soil, or the organic material on the soil, or the bark on top holds the ions on. And then if we have enough rain or you water enough that that soil or bark flows off into the storm drain system, you've created pollution. So we don't want you applying phosphorus unnecessarily. And here it would almost always be unnecessarily. If you incorporate it, you prevent that runoff problem. But excess phosphorus in the root zone suppresses the growth of the important soil mycorrhizae. So we don't want you applying phosphorus unless you're deficient in it. So again, we come back to get your soil tested first.
Well, I think it's time to move on
yes,
from
please.
This topic.
Let's talk about something cheerful.
No. Oh. The next one is boxwood blight.
Oh, this is cheerful.
So, not really. Not really. I'm going to read this little description. Boxwood blight has been seen to be most severe in sites with high precipitation and high humidity during the summer, such as in the state of Georgia in the United States.
Yeah.
We do not have high humidity in the summer. We do not have any precipitation in the summer. So why are we even talking about boxwood blight, Don?
Yeah, this came up because of a consultation I was doing, and there was a homeowners association landscape committee, and someone either on or tangential to the landscape committee said, what about boxwood for this site? Oh, sure, boxwood grows practically anything, anywhere. It's a very, very adaptable plant. Not exciting, but it certainly is well known in the U.S.
And you can sculpt it into little figurines and make a Mickey Mouse if you want.
You can prune it any way you want. Yes, horrible things are done to boxwood. But then a few years back, boxwood blight showed up in the United States, originally in the U.K. and then in the United States. And it's a big problem back east. It has pretty specific temperature and moisture requirements that are very, very, very unlikely for it to establish out here. When we're in the nursery industry and when we're also, you know, professional gardeners and landscapers, we try to track this stuff. Our industry publications will tell us when a new pest has arrived. And the first question we have is, do we have the environmental conditions here that will favor rapid spread of this particular pest? Or is it just going to be another thing we might occasionally see here? We're not rainy in the summer. The combination of high precipitation and high humidity doesn't happen here in the summer. So that's good. If it does occur, like say plants that are brought in from out of state, it'll almost certainly just cure itself, most likely. It grows at 50 degrees and above. It's inhibited at 85 degrees and it's killed at 92. And our average summer high temperature here, June, July, and August, is 92 to 93. So it's killed by our normal summer temperature conditions in the Sacramento Valley. But we do have listeners in the Bay Area, in coastal Southern California, where you would be in the right temperature range, but you don't get rainfall then. You get fog, but not rainfall.
And unless you sprinkle with an overhead sprinkler,
yeah, you're
making your own rain.
Those who breed and develop woody plants will almost always set to work trying to find resistant strains, species, create hybrids that are resistant, and they have done so. So if
and that's where we get to the good news.
Yes, Tom. The good news here. Yes.
There is a website called newgenboxwood.com.
Yeah.
In a new generation of boxwood. And it talks about the various varieties. I see three listed here in this article, resistant to blight.
Yeah, resistant to the blight and have a similar growth habit to existing boxwood that you would be familiar with. So if you're in a place where you're concerned about this, you're a landscaper, a designer, look for Independence, Freedom, and Liberty Bell.
Great. Oh, right.
Great names.
Because these were all created recently.
In yes.
created the exuberation of the 250th
yes.
anniversary.
And yeah. So Independence is like green beauty. If you've ever seen a boxwood hedge in our area, it's almost surely green beauty. That's the most common Japanese boxwood hedge around. Well, this one looks like that, Independence. There's a very short boxwood hedge called Winter Gem, which only gets like 2 feet. So you can use it for little miniature hedges. There's a version called Freedom, New Gen Freedom. And then Liberty Bell, which duplicates a ground covering form of boxwood that I only became acquainted with fairly recently. There's a form that only grows typically to 2 to 3 feet tall and spreads 4 to 5 feet. So it makes kind of a mass planting area if you just want a shiny green mass planting. And that's called Liberty Bell. So if you're listening,
carve it into a dragon shape.
Sure, you can. Boxwoods are the classic for topiary. Other than yews, which are used more in colder climates, boxwoods are classic for this.
So these aren't necessary here because we don't have the blight problem,
Right.
but would they grow as well here as their originators?
Apparently, yeah. So there's no. You might see these in one of the nursery chains in Sacramento, or one of the bigger hardware type places, Home Depot, Lowe's, the places that buy nationally. Don't be surprised if you see Independence there instead of Green Beauty, and it should function just the same for you. These appear to be great. I mean, boxwood is not a plant anyone gets excited about, but what impressed me about this plant way back when I was a hort student was that it seemed to be able to grow at almost any exposure. There is a big building on campus. I don't know if this hedge is still there, but the hedge went all the way around all four sides of the building. So we learned it as hort students, and they're introducing us to it. Actually was the Green Beauty Japanese boxwood. North, east, south, and west sides of a building. There aren't very many shrubs that'll do that. Like Nandina, privets, boxwood. Actually, boxwood did it very well. And it was there as a clipped hedge, and it was taking all those different exposures. I have used boxwood as an unpruned hedge, which it's very attractive for. You almost never see this. But I planted regular Green Beauty boxwood to line a path, and we just have let it grow now for 8 years. It's 7 feet tall. It's a little more informal because we haven't clipped it at all, so you can see through it a bit, which actually is really nice. It's a very attractive plant when you leave it unpruned. So give that some thought if you want to stop all the constant clipping in your landscape. If you're looking in the nursery and you're looking at boxwood hedges, don't be surprised if you start to see Independence, Freedom, and Liberty Bell along with Green Beauty. And in the coastal zones, you tend to see the English boxwood with a narrower leaf, a very, I would call it more refined looking, more attractive looking plant in many ways. My experience with that, it does not take dry heat as well as the other forms of boxwood. So that's more for people in coastal, milder climates.
Let's continue with an upbeat
Yes,
thing.
please.
You sent me a list, and the title of it is Flowers for Summer. And
Yeah.
the first section is annual flowers, and there's a lot of flowers in here. I know the reason that he did this. Somebody came in to him and said, "Oh, it's so hot in the summer. You don't have any flowers that can bloom in the heat in the summer in Davis, do you?"
Right,
And
because
he went, amaranthus, angelica, and there's like 20 annuals right here in front of me.
Yeah, so there's a
And
lot
he's
of
got another page of perennials.
there are things that love the heat. Many plants that love the valley heat and that love the desert conditions in Southern California, and many of these can also be grown in coastal areas. This is something,
Cosmos and dahlias and begonias and, oh, foxglove.
And
Oh,
these are
yeah.
all things that the key with each one is when do you plant them? How do you plan for a succession of bloom? How do you mix these in your garden? But there's lots of things that love the summer temperatures here and others that tolerate them, but are perhaps better in the bridge seasons of spring and fall. We talked briefly at one point about 55 to 85 degrees being an absolutely ideal temperature for gardening and for people. 55 to 85 degrees, I believe, is actually the comfort index that the National Weather Service uses for, when we're comfortable somewhere in that range. You all know this. Those are the great temperatures for being out there and doing things. There are plants that only like that range. Nasturtiums are a good example. They thrive here in the spring. They thrive here in the fall. When it gets over 90 in the summer, and it gets really low humidity, they look unhappy. They stress. They'll live. They'll survive it. They'll make it through the summer. They might even bloom. It's best if they're in some shade in the summer. But clearly, they prefer the spring to early summer and fall and into early winter before we get to freezing weather. And nasturtiums also will usually survive frost. So they can be a year-round thing, but they like that 55 to 85 degree range. Well, there are plants that are very happy above 90. And I have been sort of going through these, exploring the different groups over the years to see which ones make great garden flower plants, great background plants for the border, and so on. And I'd mention a couple of them that I have just been really impressed with for the valley, for interior parts of Southern California. And many of these will do well in the coastal zones as well, and up into the mountains with later planting. And amaranthus, alphabetically, first on the list. Of course, it's a grain crop, but there's also very ornamental versions of amaranthus, 4 to 5 feet tall. So you're not going to see these in garden centers, even in six packs, because they're just not the kind of thing that the public buys as a starter plant. We're trying them in 4-inch pots and finding they're selling okay that way, but it's the kind of thing you typically will do from seed. And a couple others in that category, celosia, Coxcomb is the crested version. Plume flower is the non-crested version. Been one of my favorite plants ever since I moved to the Valley because it loves hot, dry conditions. Cosmos, I don't even usually plant it out until June. It loves the heat and it gives a great late summer and fall bloom. Portulaca, which has kind of fallen out of favor, but it's a great ground covering annual. You can sometimes find that in six packs. It's also very easy from seed, one of the easiest from seed.
Okay, so Portulaca has a weed relative.
Oh,
right?
yes, in that family.
And we're not talking about that one. We're talking about the one with the beautiful flowers.
Yes, there is a common name of one of the Portulacas is purslane. Definitely a weed, a very common weed in this area. And there's some new hybrid Portulacas that have come on the market that look just like purslane with prettier flowers. So anyway, easy to grow. They love the heat. Salvias is a huge group, but in particular for the, speaking of annual flowers, the Salvia coccinea, the scarlet sage, and all of the new versions of that that have come on the market. Fantastic garden plants, strong colors. Many of these are things that you need to start yourself. And some of them require pretty long lead time. But the ones I've just mentioned are things you can direct seed May to June, and they'll bloom, or plant them in pots and plant them out, and they'll bloom great in your garden for you all through the summer and all the way into the fall, and even sometimes here into the early winter. There's two others I'll mention, zinnias, of course, which are great for this purpose, and verbena. Verbena is very popular, very heat tolerant. It's used in the desert areas for a ground cover. And when I mention it here, I'm mentioning that there are annual forms of verbena that are great garden plants as well. Some places you're growing the perennial forms as annuals because you're too cold for them to make it through the winter. Here we grow verbena as a ground cover or a perennial, but there are also bedding annual varieties of verbena. And these are strong colors and they love the heat.
So I have a question for you regarding all of these heat-loving plants. Are there ones that if you put them in a pot, they would trail over the side? Because that's what I'm liking. And not a hanging pot. They can't water fast enough. Right. But a nice big pot and have something else going up at the top. And then there's just some stalks or stems. And then I want it to drip.
You're referring to the spillers.
I am.
You know, spillers. Your container formula, yeah. The thrillers, the fillers, and the spillers. And so the thriller is the upright thing that's dramatic and has an accent leaf or a spiky flower or something like that. One that's blooming right now that's great for that is gay feather, Liatris, spiky plant, thriller. Fillers are the fluffy, shrubby-looking things. Pufias are great for that purpose, Mexican heather. Spillers are the ones that cascade over the side. So Lobelia is one that loves the spring and the fall, but doesn't really love the summer heat here. The Portulaca that we talked about trails beautifully. It's a ground covering plant. It trails. Verbena is another one that would do that. And Sweet Alyssum will certainly do it as well. And that's a year-round flower for this area. So those are some of your annual spillers. And there are others. Oftentimes people who design these things prefer to use perennials as the spillers because they're just, you know, they're all season. One that's really good for that is the silver leaf form of dichondra, for example. Cascades over the side, makes a nice contrast. I will go ahead and mention petunias. I personally have a sort of a love-hate relationship with them because they draw budworm, caterpillar, and all that kind of thing. But I can't really argue with the amount of bloom modern petunias give. Even if they get budworm, they bloom so much they outgrow it. And these new hybrids like the Wave series first and then the Bubblegum series, these just bloom. It's a stunning amount of flowers, very strong colors, and they cascade for the most part. Most of them, when they are in your container, if they go over the side, they will hang down the side and make a nice trailing effect. Big advantage of that, it helps to shade the container. So if you've got a bunch of plants grouped together and you've got your thrillers in there and you've done your fillers and there's sun beating down on the side of that container, stick a couple of verbena or portulaca right on the edge and let them cascade over the side and they'll help to shade the pot, keep the soil.
And it's an aesthetic choice. Yeah. Personally, I skip the fillers. Have a strong upright thing, or maybe it's a tree where the stems are bare up for a couple of feet, and then just the flowing over the side kinds of stuff.
That was just the annuals. I didn't even mention the status or the Mexican sunflower or some of the others. There's lots of perennials as well that can bloom nicely in the summer here in full sun. That includes things like our California fuchsia, Epilobium, formerly Zauschneria. It includes succulents like Delasperma ice plant, which is one that is not invasive, that does extremely well here and is actually cold tolerant. The milkweeds that are being grown for, you know, for the monarch butterflies are great summer flowers. The native ones, Fascicularis and Speciosa, summer blooming. Of the perennials that I've noted on this list, the one that has really startled me with how vigorous, how abundant and how floriferous it is Nicotiana, the flowering tobacco. Nicotiana is the way it's spelled. Nicotiana is how I usually hear it pronounced. Poisonous, it's tobacco. Keep that in mind. So, you know, if you've got kids that graze on the foliage out there, they probably shouldn't eat that one. It blooms year round. I've been super impressed with this, with the whole group of Nicotianas. I have pictures of them in bloom every month of the year. They heavy bloom in the summer, but also heavy bloom in the early winter, very commonly. Old-fashioned versions, the reason these didn't really stay in the trade is they're 3 to 4 feet tall when they're blooming. And it's like a wall of flowers, and the evening moths are attracted to them. Hummingbirds are attracted to them. There's some really amazing colors out there. I have a lime green flowered one. I have lots of pictures of that one because it's absolutely fascinating. And it's just been a group of plants that I've only been able to do by either starting my own seed and selling them, planting them directly, or starting them and putting them into bigger pots because they're big, vigorous plants for sale in either quart pots or gallon cans. But you only need one to get a really big plant with a lot of bloom, and they will reseed themselves somewhat. I won't say they become a huge problem, but they do naturalize a bit. The old-fashioned long tubular flowered one, Tubiflora, does reseed quite a bit. But the garden hybrids, they just pop up here and there. They're not that big a nuisance.
Don, I wanted to ask you about lilikoi, which is a passion flower, passion fruit that grows in Hawaii. Mm-hmm. And I met up with it in the 90s when the first time we went to Hawaii. And I met a lady who lived there who came back all excited. And she had this bowl of yellow fruit. It was about the little bigger than a walnut. Mm-hmm. And she was all excited because it was lilikoi. And so she cut them all open and juiced them and turned the juice into the best pie I think I've ever had. Lilikoi pie is wonderful. And she taught my husband how to do it. And there is a company called Auntie Lilikoi they are in Kauai, which is one of the islands of the Hawaiian island chain. And they get their local lilikoi fruit and squeeze it and make things out of it. So you can buy lilikoi juice from Auntie Lilikoi and have them shipped to you, which we have done for many, many, many years so that Jim can make lilikoi pie for us.
Well, I have had people ask, of course, if we can grow passion fruit here. Lilikoi is a passion fruit. Everything that we call a passion fruit is in the genus Passiflora. Many of them are in the species Passiflora edulis. My understanding is that lilikoi is a yellow version, a subspecies of Passiflora edulis that is all over Hawaii. It's not native there, but it's definitely taken over the place. So the question is whether you can grow passion fruit here. Now, years ago when we first opened, none of the growers we worked with were growing passion fruit particularly. Most of them were considered too tender to grow here, first of all. And that is an issue. We're at, right on the edge of where they can be grown. And the answer to the question of whether you can grow it is going to depend on where you're listening. There is a passion fruit that will grow practically anywhere, but most of them are subtropical to tropical species. Passiflora refers to both passion flowers and passion fruit. They're all in the same genus. There are something like 4,000 species and cultivars in the genus Passiflora, the overwhelming majority of which are from truly tropical regions or subtropical enough that they are not hardy to grow outdoors here. Some of them in subtropical parts of California or frost-free parts or low frost incidence parts of California can become very, very locally invasive. I do remember an alley in La Jolla, California that was completely filled with a red flowered Passiflora. It was quite cool, but also was major haven for rodents and things like that. Very overgrown. It was a big job. My mom planted Passiflora, Alato ceruli, the only one that was common in the trade back then. Built their house right near UCSD, didn't have much money for landscaping, so they just built a fence with just a trellis all around it. And my mom alternated, ready for this, Japanese honeysuckle and passion flower on the separate panels of that fence. In the long run, the honeysuckle won out over about a 20-plus year period. But for the first 10 years plus, it was quite spectacular and definitely provided privacy very, very quickly. My job as an early teenager was snipping them from overwhelming everything. And then they finally paid a crew to come in and take the whole thing out. My job after that was digging out remaining root suckers from both plants. And of the two, the Japanese honeysuckle was worse, but the passiflora definitely was a problematic species. So in frost-free areas, be very careful about which members of the genus you plant, whether you're after the fruit or the flowers. But in the interior, we have an advantage, which is that frost controls the size of a lot of members of the genus.
A
The key,
lot of, but not all.
not all. There's one called Mapop, Passiflora incarnata, which is used medicinally, has a pretty enough flower. It spreads by root suckers really vigorously. Well, my recollection is it could go down to about two zones colder than here. And so it can become a real problem even in colder climate zones. It dies to the ground, but the root system survives. In our area, Passifloras, there are several that are hardy enough to grow here that look even okay during the winter. Passiflora edulis for passion fruit will be harmed each winter. Even this last winter, where we didn't have much freezing weather, the amount of very cold fog we had in November and early December did a lot of damage to Passiflora edulis. So if you plant one, you're in Sunset Zone 8, 9, or 14, USDA Zone 9, which is where we are. Expect winter injury. Expect them to freeze back somewhat or die back somewhat, depending on the type of cold we get. Plan on cutting them back when we get to April or May. You'll get very vigorous regrowth during the summer, and there's a very good chance you'll still get enough time for them to flower and fruit since the flowers come in the spring and the summer, and the fruit comes in the summer and ripens into the fall. You can grow passion fruit here in the valley, and you can grow passion fruit in interior Southern California as well. If you're frost free, be very careful where you plant it because they not only run and hold on to things, but they also tend to send out root suckers. So Passiflora edulis is on the tender end of the genus for our area. People coming to my nursery right now are asking every day, what is that vine on your fence? Because a Passiflora, it sets large amounts of hollow fruit. They're very pretty. They're bright orange. Okay, Blue Horizon, that's the variety. There it is. Blue Horizon, which is a nice ornamental one with a very pretty large flower, and it sets these orange fruit. And if you tear them open, there are seeds in there. There's a little bit of pulp, but it wouldn't be worth the effort of scooping it out and making use of it. It's edible, but not particularly great. But they're on there and they're hanging on there. So people keep asking, oh, can we grow passion fruit here? Yes, you can, but they won't cover the fence like this one has. This is a hardy type. This one just doesn't happen to have edible fruit. Edulis will cover roughly one panel of fence each summer in our climate. It'll produce 2 to 3 dozen fruit that we'll talk about that in a moment, that you wait and wait and wait to eat them. And then it'll freeze back and you'll cut it back and it'll come back and do that year after year. The most difficult year is the first winter when you put it in, when you probably need to cover it or make sure if we get unusually cold that you give it a little added protection here.
So Don sent me an article, and it is from Monterey Bay Nursery. It includes so many pictures. It's amazing.
Monterey Bay NSY.com is their website. Lewin at Monterey Bay has one of the most photo intensive websites I've ever seen. Just Nancy Garrison alone, he has a picture of the flower, the young fruit, the fruit ready to pick, the fruit ready to eat, and the growth habit of the plant.
I'm looking at the pictures that Don sent me in this article,
Yep.
and there's one where the is that the sepals or is that petals, the ring of white flags around the outside?
Those are petals.
Petals, okay. Inside of which there is a fringe of purple in the center and white on the outside, frilly, curly.
Yeah.
It's amazing, like fringe.
That's
Then
part of, yeah, that's always been part of what attracts people to them is the flowers have these fascinating structures. They're four, some of them are as much as 4 or 5 inches in diameter. Some of them hang down like jellyfish with these long trailing things from them. And they're, as an ornamental plant, they're quite interesting. And most of those don't set fruit at all. So that's something to be aware of is that most of them do not fruit, but they have really cool flowers. That's the first thing that attracts people to them.
another one of the pictures is the fruit, and I think this is the red passion flower.
Red Rover, yeah.
Yeah, and it shows a picture of a person supporting it on the vine, so you can see it's still hanging on the vine, but it's as big as the palm of their hand. I mean, it's huge.
Yeah,
It's
so
not. It's not a little tiny walnut sized thing. It's huge.
For a long time, the only Passiflora edulis that were on the market were smaller and had to practically look like they were spoiled before you could pick them. Patrick Worley is worth mentioning as a individual who would take on a group of plants and start hybridizing within that group of plants. He brought into the market some of the best known salvia hybrids that you've been growing now for 25 or 30 years. He's the one that crossed Microphylla and Greggii and introduced a bunch of new salvia cultivars. And he also worked on the genus Passiflora, the species edulis at one point. And so they just call these Patrick Worley creations. He crossed a couple of varieties to create three well-known varieties. These are pretty much the ones you're going to run into in garden centers now. Nancy Garrison is not one of his. That came from Monterey Bay Nursery. Frederick is one of his, very common in the trade now because very high quality fruit. Red Rover, I believe, is another one of his, and he's bred some others. And a couple more have come on the market, one called Bounty, which is more cold hardy. So if you're listening to us in USDA Zone 7, you can actually grow Bounty there. It's a cross between two different species. This one came to my attention recently. Self-fertile, you only need one. You don't have to hand pollinate them, which you have to do with some of the other types. It's a good flavor. It's a sweet one. It's a purple fruit. It's very productive. It's a very fast-growing plant and can go down to USDA Zone 7. It's the only one I know of that has good fruit that grows in a climate that cold. And there's two others that have come on the market. One is Panama Red. All I know about that is just has really big fruit. One called Possum Purple. I thought, why are they calling this Possum Purple? Does it look like a possum? Does it? I don't know. Well, it was from Robert Barnum of Possum Trot Farm in Florida. So named it after his business. Hardy to the upper 20s with protection. And that's an important distinction. Passifloras, for the most part, Passiflora edulis, 30 to 31 degrees will injure them. It'll kill the new growth. It'll do some damage to the exposed leaves, and the plant will get a much yellower appearance as soon as we get to about 30 or 31. And there'll be pretty significant injury. What he's saying, what they're saying, is this one will go down into the upper 20s. So Possum Purple is coming into the trade because of its good flavor and slightly improved cold hardiness. Bounty, Bounty.
The last picture I want to talk to you about with the passion fruit, passion flower, is again from Monterey Bay Nursery in this article. And it has a vine. It looks like growing from the ground up a trellis,
Yeah.
above the into the second story and across on a ledge over a balcony. And it's huge. It's like it's taking over this entire building. It's amazing.
A single plant can easily go to 30 feet in a frost-free climate. This plant, he comments here, survived 25 degrees without damage. And I'm looking at this building, and probably the wall gave it added protection. And that's a good place for these. Finding a slightly frost-protected location would improve the vigor of the plant and improve its survivability rate. The 1990 freeze, which was epic in this area, we got to 16 degrees in Davis. In 1990, the all-time record low temperature below 20 degrees and lower, it actually recovered from that. Now, I'm assuming that it came back from the ground, but it was fruiting by late spring or early summer of 1991, according to Nancy, for whom Nancy Garrison is named. USDA Zone 9 is okay for Nancy Garrison. Someone asked me, how do these taste? And I wanted to say, well, I've never been to a fruit tasting of passion fruit. I've sampled some of these. They are very, very tart until they're fully ripe and slightly rotted. So Passiflora is one of these fruit, and there's a picture on the link here, slightly wrinkled, ready to eat. You should probably, before you buy them, go to this website and look at what a passion fruit looks like that you're going to grow in your own yard and harvest. It looks like it's spoiled. The wait, and you pick them when they're beginning to turn past perfect, and then you let them sit until they go to slightly spoiled. It's one of those fruit that needs to, I'm not going to say ferment, it needs to break down a bit to get the sugar content up and the acid content down for most people to find it palatable. Or use the pulp, add a lot of sugar, and bake it in a pie.
Use the juice, not the pulp. You scoop the innards out and you blend it in a blender, seeds and all, and then you strain it and you end up with lily koi juice.
And Lois and I both remember being in Hawaii and seeing Lilikoi, which appears to be the yellow version of Passiflora edulis. We're remembering, I was like 10 years old, we're on the horseback ride, and these things were hanging over the trail. So my dad picked one, cut it with his knife, and we ate it. I was remembering that.
Ooh,
It
sour.
was pretty tart. I liked tart fruit. That was fine. But that's not how you normally eat them. You normally have to let them go further along, sort of like medlar. And persimmons, there's a term called bletting, BLETTING. Medlar is the classic English fruit that has to be picked, allowed to be exposed to frost, allowed to slightly spoil in the root cellar, then they're sweet. This is not fully in that category, but it has to be a little bit on the spoiled end of things before you're really likely to eat them. Kids will probably be fine with them perfectly tart. You'll probably want to add more sugar.
Well, here's a question for you, Don. Why don't large nursery growers carry a good selection of native plants?
It's a challenge for them to grow native plants for a whole region that are going to be appropriate to different plant communities. That would be one concern I would have. But the biggest,
Oh, because native plants are so specialized, they like to grow.
they also have unique propagation and production issues. Their soils are different and their management is different. And that does not fit into the production schedules and practices of large wholesale growers. The soil type, overhead irrigation or drip irrigation, fertilizer practices, and any pest management. Well, unfortunately, woody California natives are especially susceptible to root and crown rot. When your ceanothus dies and you go to ask the nursery what happened, they're going to say to you, you overwatered it. What they really mean is you created conditions favorable to infection by Phytophthora cinnamomi because you put irrigation too close to the stem under high temperature conditions. And so they have to develop a soil mix just for woody natives, right? Different drains faster, larger pore sizes. They need to be pinched or trimmed, which is true of many nursery plants, to get them to branch and give sufficient density. That's just basically for shelf appeal. So this does make a great opportunity for small specialty nurseries, but that's where you'll probably need to go to get a good selection of well-grown native plants and also have different expectations for how they're going to appear. These are not typically plants that make a good retail sales quality product. So it's a little more challenging for nurseries to deal with them.
Don sends me flower pictures every week. It's wonderful. And this week he sent me a picture of this thing. It is not a flower, Don. What planet is it?
Technically it was a
Well, it
flower.
was, but it doesn't have flower parts anymore.
They're inside. I sent you a picture of a fig. A
That's a
fig.
fig.
That's a fig. That is a wonderful fig called panache or panache. I've heard it pronounced both ways. In this country, they're usually selling it as tiger stripe because, as you can see, it's a striped fig. It's developing and expanding now in July. They'll be ripe in August, September. Panache is a very sweet fig that has become available to the home garden market. So if you're looking for a fig that's a great one for your backyard, it's actually an excellent choice for this area. Panache is a fig that will get to 20 by 20 with no problem if you let it, but it's like all figs, very easy to prune. You don't need any special skill to prune figs. You just have to be diligent and persistent about it because they mostly will get pretty big. But this one is a beautiful fig itself that attracts people. It has the stripe on the fruit, even to some degree when it's ripe. It's very, very sweet with sort of a strawberry-like flavor. Lots of figs available here in Northern California. 100 varieties easily out there that you could get a hold of if you join the rare fruit growers and so forth. But your average nursery is going to sell Black Mission or brown turkey. Those are the two classic California figs. There are many other varieties that I think are sweeter, richer flavored, juicier, more useful for certain purposes. Nothing wrong with Black Mission. It's a great fig for drying. Nothing wrong with brown turkey. It's sort of the classic backyard fig. But many of these are better. They have more flavor. They have a little firmer skin so they don't get damaged so easily by weather problems and so forth. So if you're planting a fig, do a little exploring about the different varieties that are available. I think you might like Panache or Panache.
So, Don, this is the second week of June, July, excuse me. And what are you harvesting now? And what are you planting now?
I am harvesting pickling cucumbers. It's the first time I've done this in years. I don't even remember the last time I did this. One of my staff mentioned wanting to make pickles. I thought, well, pickling cucumbers are easy to grow. But one of the issues with pickling cucumbers is that you have to have a lot of them to process all at once, and you need them very small. So you have to keep picking, keep picking, keep picking, keep storing, keep storing, keep storing until you have enough to process. Or you plant varieties that produce very heavily, very rapidly. And that is what I have found is a variety called Adam, like Adam and Eve, Adam Gherkin. It's about a 3-inch cucumber when you pick it at its perfect stage. It gets to 6 inches if you wait 4 or 5 days, and that's too big, but you can still use it. And I planted these in the first week of May, and I no, the third week of May, looking at my notes, and I picked my first batch of them a week ago at the 1st of July, late June. So 6 weeks after planting, I picked enough to hand off to this staff person to make her first batch of pickles. And yesterday I handed her another bowl of them to make another batch of pickles. What I'm learning about pickling cucumbers, if you're going to do this yourself, plant a bunch of the same variety. I did 6 of each. Plant them so that you can get at them easily and pick as quickly as you can as well. They're still small, and probably these vines will be played out in terms of yield in another like 4 or 5 weeks. We'll be done. We'll have everything she needs from them and we'll move on. But I planted 3 varieties, and of the 3, Adam Gherkin is producing heavily already, and the other 2 are just beginning to flower. So if you want to have them over a longer period of time, perhaps plant a couple different types or do staggered plantings through the season. I would say if something will produce pickling cucumbers 6 weeks after planting, then in our climate, you could probably plant some more in late August and get a late crop of them. And I'm going to try that, so I'll let you know. I'm trying 3 different varieties so far. Adam Gherkin is really impressing me.
So Don, zucchini, you pick them when they're little, and if you miss one, you get this giant boat.
It's like cucumbers.
If you have pickling cucumbers and you pick them when they're little and you miss one, is it still edible?
Yeah, they're used for chow chow or bread and butter pickles or things like that. They're used in relishes rather than for solid pickles because they get a little more watery and the texture isn't great. Pickling cucumbers were generally selected for a firmer texture, first of all, and for holding up pretty well. But yes, within 5 days of being the right size, that cucumber is too big really to use for pickling whole. So you end up doing other things. You slice them, you do bread and butter pickles, things like that. I mean, chow chow is a recipe that we used to make years ago with end of the season cucumbers. You take all different sizes and you chop them all up and you mix them with the mustard and vinegar combination and so forth. It's a late season using it up kind of approach. But for good quality pickles, you want to get them small and you want to keep picking them. So I'm picking them, storing them, picking them, rinsing them, storing them dry until I have a whole bowl of them and then taking them in. But it appears that 6 plants will give you quite a large number if you're looking for just one season's worth of homemade pickles.
So this week I have 2 quotes. The first is from Graham Stewart Thomas, who lived in the 1900s. And this is as a firm resolution should be made to purchase only a plant for a place and never to come home wondering where to place the plant in your hand. And then my other quote is from Herbert.
I would never function that way.
I know. I understand. This is advice, Don. This is not
advice that I do not heed.
Observation of Don.
Yes. Yes.
This person, Herbert Duran, said, "No plant goes into my garden unless a place is ready to receive it, which everything is needful for its prosperity and safety has been provided."
Who are these people?
They lived a long time ago.
Actually,
and they're not Don and they're not Lois.
Yes.
And Lois's quote is, "What do I do with this plant?"
Yes. Walking up and down an 800-foot border with a 1-gallon perennial going, "I literally have no place left to plant this." Huh. Graham Stewart Thomas was actually a well-known English horticulturist, and one of the very best David Austin roses is named after him because Graham Stewart Thomas was one of the early promoters, if you will, of heirloom or 19th and 18th century roses. And so David Austin admired him greatly. And the Graham Thomas rose is a very, very good rose. You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore
and Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.